I call the meeting of the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee to order. A quorum is present. Representative Fisher, have you looked at the minutes from February 1st?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I've looked at the minutes from February 1st, and I'd like to move their approval.
Representative Fisher moves the minutes for February 1st, 2023. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. The motion prevails. First up, we have House File 24, Representative Jordan. Lead service lines. Representative Jordan, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 24 be re-referred to the Capital Investment Committee.
Representative Jordan moves that House File 24 be recommended be re-referred to the Capital Investment Committee. Representative Jordan, I also have the A3 amendment I would like to adopt now if we could. I will move the A3 amendment. Members, the A3 amendment adds in provisions relating to what happens to the lead when we collect it. Where does it go? So their lead service lines, when they're collected, the reporting requirement that is in front of this committee would be there. It also prioritizes lead service lines recipients when there's an imminent threat to public health or safety, and then definitions of lead service line and service line. Are there any questions to the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. The A3 amendment is adopted. Representative Jordan, to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair Hansen and members of the committee. I am excited to present House File 24, which is a bill to protect Minnesotans from exposure to lead in their drinking water through lead service lines. Members, this is fundamentally a bill to protect Minnesotans from exposure to lead. And if there is one takeaway I'd like us all to walk away from, it is that no amount of exposure to lead is safe. Lead service lines are one of the largest sources of lead in Minnesota's drinking water. And often the lead service lines are both publicly and privately owned. Both parts of the line must be replaced simultaneously to avoid increasing lead concentration in our drinking water. Lead exposure through drinking water is a statewide issue. These service lines are present across Minnesota in all communities, urban, suburban, and rural, but lead exposure through service lines is most common in lower income communities. Many cities and townships also do not have a comprehensive map of lead lines, actually most. This bill is critical not only for our health and safety through our drinking water, but it is also critical that we pass this bill now to maximize federal funding provided by the bipartisan infrastructure law Congress passed in 2021 and to provide the assistance Minnesota communities need to be in compliance with federal law. House File 24 works in that it establishes eligible recipients and uses of the grants. Eligible recipients are basically anyone who runs a community water supply, so community public water suppliers of a community water system, municipalities, suppliers of other residential drinking water systems, and any applicant eligible for loans and grants under the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act. The eligible uses of this grant funding include removing and replacing lead lines, construction costs, the information to inform residents on the benefits and timing of removing the lead lines, and repaying any debt incurred for above uses. Grant money can be used to pay for 100% of the cost of replacing privately owned lead lines and only 50% of those lines that are publicly owned. And that is because of the IIJA structure. This bill also promotes planning by grant recipients. In particular, it states that the PFA, or Public Facilities Authority, must give priorities to cities, local water systems, and other applicants that use grant proceeds as part of a plan to remove all lead lines in their jurisdictions. Plans need to include how the recipient will maximize the number of participating property owners, including property owners with portions of lead water lines that are privately owned, how the recipient will maximize the efficient use of funds by coordinating the replacement of privately owned and publicly owned portion of lead lines, how the recipient, so again, the municipality or the water system, will minimize the partial replacement, and how equity for disadvantaged groups is prioritized in the plan. Also, with the new, with the amendment that was just adopted, there are also reporting details on how the lead was stored and disposed of, descriptions of how we are protecting our workers from lead contamination, and then it also creates additional priorities based on more imminent threats to public health or safety, based on an imminent threat to public health or safety. This bill also requires that grant applicants have at least 50,000 water connections. So these would be some of our largest systems in the state. They must also submit a workforce plan as part of their application that describes how the applicant, so for example, the city of St. Paul, will maximize the use of registered apprentices and workers from communities that are underrepresented in our construction industry. There is a prevailing wage component that is consistent with existing state law and the federal IIJA needs. And it also creates a report that we'll all get. And then there are also the mapping grants, which are important because the feds are requiring all of our municipalities to have these maps produced by October of 2024. And so we will have that. Those maps must be done for federal compliance, and this will actually give the money to these water systems to produce those maps. And then it also appropriates money from the general fund for that. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would like to proceed to testimony and discussion.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. Looks like first up we have John Thorson, La Una. Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is John Thorson. I'm with La Una, Minnesota, North Dakota. We're Minnesota's infrastructure union, representing more than 13,000 skilled construction laborers who build and maintain our roads, bridges, highways, basic utilities, and basic infrastructure that allow our communities to thrive. We're proud to stand with the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, Conservation Minnesota, Operating Engineers Local 49, St. Paul Regional Water Services, and the Associated General Contractors in seeking a transformational investment in our state's future that puts us on a path to remove what the Minnesota Department of Health estimates to be over 100,000 lead service lines in communities all throughout the state. We strongly support the provisions of House File 24 that call for eliminating all lead service lines by 2033 and provide the funding necessary to ensure that cities can map, identify, and replace lead pipes, both in the public right-of-way and the approximately 70% of service lines that are on private property. Again, this is an issue that is prevalent all throughout the state, and who's most at risk to have a lead service line for drinking water? It's Minnesotans living in older homes, especially those constructed before 1945, are at the most risk of having a lead service line. Historically, lead was used because it was less expensive than iron, could more easily be bent around existing structures without leaking, and allowed more durable connections to stiffer pipes that expand and contract with temperature. La Una members are skilled in lead service line replacement and have worked with cities all throughout the nation to accelerate the identification and removal of lead pipes in communities. And here in Minnesota, it's estimated that removal and replacement of lead service lines will create and maintain around 2,400 jobs annually over the next 10 years. We're also very excited about the career and economic inclusion opportunities this brings to Minnesota's construction industry through union registered apprenticeship programs that increase participation of women, people of color, veterans, and others not yet fully participating to their full potential in our economy. The socioeconomic impacts of a job that pays middle class wages, provides comprehensive family health care and retirement benefits, and offers training and career advancement can exceed those created by lower wage, low benefit jobs by a factor of five or more. Mr. Chair, I want to thank Representative Jordan for bringing this proposal forward and encourage members of the committee to support House File 24 and these critical state investments to ensure that lead pipes are replaced and clean drinking water is delivered to families and children all across Minnesota. This is an investment that will increase the health, social, and economic vitality of our entire state. Thank you.
Thank you. And members, we're going to save questions until all the testifiers are done. Patrick Shea, St. Paul Regional Water Services. Welcome, and state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Patrick Shea. I'm the general manager for St. Paul Regional Water Services. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in favor of House File 24. As a regional water utility providing drinking water to over 450,000 customers and residents, we are governed by the Board of Water Commissioners. Our water system here in St. Paul consists of nearly 100,000 service lines. 26,000 of them contain some portion of lead. These assets are currently not owned by the utility, yet the result of ignoring them comes at a great public cost. As a provider of drinking water, providing safe and reliable drinking water is not just a goal, but the mission of our utility, and lead in drinking water is a serious health concern. In March of 2022, the St. Paul Board of Water Commissioners directed my staff to develop a 10-year lead service line replacement project. This project is called Lead-Free SPRWS. With the help of American Rescue Plan dollars from the City of St. Paul and a grant from the state of Minnesota through the Minnesota Department of Health, we were able to successfully develop the Lead-Free SPRWS program last year and plan on implementing portions of it in 2023. We have worked out numerous roadblocks, including the administrative requirements to comply with federal procurement practices, implemented several methods to complete this work. What we are currently lacking for the 10-year initiative to be successful is adequate funding. Without additional state and federal dollars, we will fall well short of removing all lead service lines in our service area over the next decade. As mentioned earlier, this is also a great opportunity for workforce development. And as part of this work, we are planning on hiring 30 people just this year alone. It is for this reason that we strongly support this bill and believe it is imperative that Minnesota makes the necessary investments to ensure lead service lines are eliminated over the next decade. I am available now and into the future to offer any questions or suggestions you may have, and I appreciate the attention to this matter. Thank you. Thank you.
Charlie Griffith, Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. Welcome and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Carly Griffith. I am the Water Program Director at the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. MCEA supports this grant program for lead service line replacement as outlined in House File 24. Childhood lead poisoning is a public health crisis that we must act quickly to address. For children under 6 years of age, lead exposure can lead to lifelong health impacts that include damage to the brain and nervous system, slowed growth and development, and behavioral problems. As a community advocate in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, I saw firsthand the impact this public health crisis had on families. I talked to mothers whose children were hospitalized for high blood lead levels, who had to tirelessly advocate for their children to get the resources they needed to deal with related cognitive and behavioral issues in school, and who then became community leaders to ensure that other children didn't have to face what their children did. Here in Minnesota, we need to get ahead of the problem while we have the resources to do so. This grant program will allow us to tackle one of the primary sources of lead exposure in our state, which is the lead pipes that deliver drinking water to our homes. A general fund appropriation for this grant program will allow us to maximize the federal funds for lead service line replacement and ensure that we are able to meet the goal to replace all drinking water service lines in the state that have lead by 2033. As we've already discussed, residential lead service lines are divided into publicly and privately owned portions, and one of the challenges with lead service line replacement is to coordinate funds to ensure that the public and privately owned portions of the pipe can be replaced at the same time. Not only is it much more cost effective to replace both at the same time, but the CDC has found that partial replacements can actually increase the risk of lead exposure and may be linked to increased incidence of high blood lead levels in children. This bill addresses that challenge in two ways. First, it requires that at least 70% of the grant funds are used to replace the privately owned portions of lead drinking water service lines. This step is critical because the private side cost share is often the greatest obstacle to coordinated lead service line replacement. And because of these resources, we can hope to see coordinated replacement at a neighborhood or census block scale. Second, the grant program prioritizes applications that identify that very fact, how the recipient will coordinate the removal of publicly and privately owned portions of the lines. Also, lead contamination is an environmental justice issue that disproportionately affects lower income families and communities of color, where decades of disinvestment have led to critical infrastructure needs, poorer health outcomes, and less economic opportunity. MCEA commends the inclusion of grant criteria to prioritize lead service line replacement for lower income residents and those from other disadvantaged communities that are at the greatest risk for lead exposure. It also, MCEA also commends the requirement for applicants who serve large customer bases to incorporate work plans that maximize the participation of those from underrepresented populations in the construction industry, and for all laborers and mechanics to be paid the prevailing wage rate for their work. Other opportunities for workforce development could include lead paint abatement. This would build on the lead service line replacement work and address another critical pathway for lead exposure in infants and young children. House File 24 contains multiple strategies that are necessary to combat the public and environmental health crisis of lead contamination, such as the mapping inventories of drinking water service lines across the state and grants that allow for the coordinated replacement of publicly and privately owned portions of the lead service lines, and the workforce development component that will help Minnesota reinvest in its communities where this work is done. Thank you.
Thank you. Eric Simonson, Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Eric Simonson. I'm a lobbyist representing the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, an advocacy organization of more than 110 cities located outside the seven county metro area. We want to express our gratitude to Representative Jordan for bringing forward House File 24, and we want to express our support of the bill as amended to the members of the committee. Cities are always at the forefront, it seems, of ensuring citizens have access to clean and safe drinking water. When citizens don't have clean or safe drinking water, who is the first person that they call? It is generally the city government. We want to draw your attention to the fact that the nature of lead pipes is not just a metro problem. It's not just a large city problem. This is a problem that affects medium and small cities all across rural Minnesota. 38% of cities in greater Minnesota have over one-third of their housing stock constructed pre-1940. And we all know there is a high likelihood that many of them contain lead pipes or are serviced by lead pipes. Members, our cities don't want Minnesota to look like other states that have waited too long to try to resolve their problem. Is it expensive? Yes. But we can all agree that drinking water through lead pipes isn't good for anyone, be it rural or metro. We strongly urge your support of House File 24. Thank you, and I'll be available for questions.
Thank you. I believe there were a couple of people who did want to testify who were unable to get on the list. Steve Morse. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, members, any questions? Representative Burkle, and then Representative Brand.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. Representative Jordan, I'm just curious. I'm looking at the eligible recipients under Subdivision 2, and I'm just wondering how these funds will be distributed. Greater Minnesota Cities, I mean, is this going to be divided equally? And then in my area, there's a lot of homeowners with private wells, myself included. Curious how they're if they're counted in this or if they have access to this program.
Representative Jordan.
Mr. Chair, the eligible recipients are community public water suppliers, municipalities, other suppliers of residential drinking waters, and then any applicant eligible for loans and grants under the Safe Drinking Water Act. Someone can correct me. I don't think private well owners would be part of this because they wouldn't. The grants would go directly to the suppliers. So it might go, in the past they've gone to the city of Royalton, for example, and then the city has been the one who has actually gone out and done the work with residents and then done the eventual replacement to maximize it. So it wouldn't be just for an individual, but it would be for, let's say you had a mobile home or manufactured home park that had its own small water supply. That mobile home water supplier could be eligible for a grant under this that would be coming from PFA. So PFA, the mapping grants would come from health, the actual replacement grants would come from PFA to your municipalities in your district. And then from there, it would be up to PFA to take in the applications from all of the municipalities and then distribute the funds that way. And I do know that Director Freeman is here and could talk more about how that would go out, if that would be helpful to members.
Representative Burkham.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. So it sounds like the answer is that there's probably no access for a private individual with a private well. But I'm just curious how that would be done, and if it's not included in the bill, then it's not. But knowing that there's no safe level of lead in water, just a concern I have.
Write a bill.
Representative Brand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question is to the bill author. I'm a co-author of this bill. I really believe in this opportunity for folks across the state of Minnesota. I believe in this so much that I would call it the lead moonshot bill, right? So we're going to get rid of lead in Minnesota. I think that's a very noble pursuit. In the bill itself, I'm looking at all the language that's contained within it. I don't hear any musts or shalls, with the exception of, I think there's a shall at the last page there about the governor or the commissioner of health must establish a grant, and I think that's about the only place where I see a must or a shall. Am I missing something other than that? I mean, this isn't a mandate. This is a carrot, correct?
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is to provide the ability. So really, cities want to do this, as you heard from Mr. Simonson earlier. Cities want to do this. We're not compelling them. However, cities are mandated by the feds to complete their mapping under the updated lead and copper rule to have the maps by October of 2024. And so that's a must that comes from DC. The real musts are telling PFA and MDH that they need to be there to help people and get this money out to people to get rid of lead. So those are really what it is. But the mandate, again, comes from the federal government.
Representative Brand.
Thank you very much. And I think the point I want to make is that I live in one of the 110 cities that represented by the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. In St. Peter, we mapped this out many years ago, and the city council at the time led with their values and said we should put together a financing plan, work with our homeowners to get every lead service line out of the city of St. Peter, and that worked with the exception of 12. There are 12 holdouts that refuse to get rid of their lead service line, and the reason being is because the government is involved. And I, you know, that's just, I guess, late adopter, early adopter, I don't know. But the bottom line is there are 12 people, 12 families, 12 residences in the city of St. Peter that refused to do it because of that situation. And in talking with my my public works director, you know, I'm surprised that 12 would not want to do something like this. But we've known that lead is a hazard to human health for 4,000 years. The Greeks actually documented how badly this can impact the human life. At some point, if our goal is to get to 2030 and have every lead service line out, I would suggest at some point somebody at the legislature try to find a way to work with those holdouts or possibly take the posture of the federal government and say it's no longer an option because this is a public health situation. That's my feedback.
Representative Jordan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brand, thank you for that. I think this is one of the unique challenges with these lead service lines is that they are both publicly and privately owned. And if you look at the service lines that are, you know, 100% publicly owned, for the most part, those have been replaced. And that's because in the past, we've been able to use bonding money for them. The Drinking Water Revolving Fund, up until a few years ago, was set up to provide those low interest or no interest loans to actually replace the publicly portioned parts of it. But the fact of the matter is there would have to be, I think that's on us. I've been trying to do a lot of education with my constituents on, you know, hopefully these programs are coming. They should be aware of it. I also think that once we have maps of where there are lead homes, and if there are only 12 homes in the city of St. Peter that have lead lines, that's going to impact the property values. And so those homeowners might want to incentivize removal of the lead lines if they don't want to sell a home that has a lead line to it. Because when you're looking for a home, if I'm looking at all the different options that are available, I'm going to choose one that is a safer environment for my family to live in.
Mm-hmm. Representative Adelson.
Th- Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Fisher had a good idea just now, is that we require it when you're selling your house. So I don't think that's kind of I like that idea. But Mr. Chair and Representative, I guess I want to just build on what Representative Brand was saying, is just making sure, how do we make sure the public is aware of this? It sounds like there's going to be the map. But also, and just if you could just speak a little bit to just the safe disposal of all of these lead lines, and is there any concerns around that, and where, I guess, what is the process for that?
Representative Jordan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edelson, there is money within here, within this. And so one of the allowable uses of this fund is to do education for homeowners. So if, let's say, the city of Edina wanted to, you know, mail all the people who had a lead line like a postcard that says, hey, you have a lead line, and city crews will be out on March 12th. You probably can't do construction. On June 12th, sorry, should have picked a different date for construction. On June 12th, we'll be doing water main work on your street, and we would like to replace the lead service line. Please check this box here to allow city staff onto your property to replace this lead line. And so that education and work to make sure people know about both the program, but also the dangers of lead, the need to replace it, is one of the allowable uses for this fund. And as to disposal, I know that when other cities are doing this, they are contracting with recyclers who then recycle the lead in a way that is above board. And maybe one of our, if we do have people here who do this work from the city of St. Paul, if they wanted to talk about it, but that is the current practice, is that the current lead is disposed of and utilized mostly into batteries, I believe.
Representative Edelson. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Jordan. Largely a very good bill, and I just have a couple of questions for you. So the federal government provided for us this appropriation, and can you just kind of walk us through how that appropriation works? From receiving it from the federal government to what we see here on page 4, the general fund appropriation being $80 million for fiscal year 24, and then the following years. And just walk us through that so that the members of this committee can understand that and how that will work.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it would be better to have Director Freeman do that.
Director Freeman, did you hear the question?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I think so. Again, my name is Jeff Freeman. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Facilities Authority. So the federal money that was in the infrastructure bill, Minnesota will receive approximately $43 million per year for 5 years. And that money comes through our existing drinking water state revolving fund, which, and it's dedicated specifically for lead service lines, but the broader fund funds all sorts of drinking water infrastructure projects. Through that process, we're required to annually prepare an intended use plan that lists the cities, well, I should back up. Initially, cities that are seeking funding to do this work will start out by applying to the Department of Health to be ranked on their project priority list. And then when they're ready to actually do the construction work, they apply to my agency for what's called the intended use plan. So there's a process in place where cities are ranked, they get on the list, and then from there, they'll work through the application process, and funding will be provided through that state revolving fund process. That's the federal side of the funds. These state funds that will supplement it, there is a requirement in the bill that they also, those cities also, all cities have to get on the project priority list. So we've got one list of all these projects, all the cities that are seeking money to do this work. And then we'll work through that list. Some will be funded with federal dollars, some will be funded with state dollars. In some cases, we may likely combine those funds to fund the whole project, both the public and the private side.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So am I understanding correctly that the federal government dollars that were sent to us don't cover the entirety of the $80 million appropriation here? Is that correct? And then the additional amount that's not provided by the federal government, that is provided for us through the general fund or through, and maybe that's to the bill author.
Jordan. Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz, that is correct.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Obviously, this is a big priority, and the amount that this this bill spends is significant, right, in directing it for the next 10 years. So my question to that end, from your understanding, Representative Jordan, we reached June 30th, 2033. Will we have removed all lead lines here in Minnesota at our best estimation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz, that's the intention of this bill. And yeah, this is a big price tag. I don't like this number. It used to be when it was first, the cost estimate, when it was first, the project was first proposed was $300 million. That was calculated several years ago. Inflation has happened. The cost of construction has gone up. The cost of replacing these lead lines doesn't go the other way. It's not going to get cheaper to do it. I think that replacing lead service lines is a good use of one-time money. A lead service line is a binary. You got one or you don't. We're not putting new ones in. And so this is a diminishing problem. This is also something that we need to get going on. Our constituents want us to protect our drinking water. And so that's the purpose of this bill. And the intent of this is to have the lines replaced within 10 years.
Thank you. This is very helpful discussion for the committee. So I really do appreciate this dialogue. Further question on page 3 here, I just kind of want to pin down on this workforce plan. So 3.18, it references applicants who serve 50,000 service connections. So many of us, especially on this side of the aisle, represent small communities. Does that mean that we are not necessarily held to those same priorities as listed here under that same subdivision 5?
Mr. Chair, this is only required of applicants who serve 50,000 service connections. And so that wouldn't even be, if you think about a city, this would be a city that would be even larger. It would be, have more, this is just service connectors. So this isn't a resident calculation. So this is just the number of lead service lines that a city might have. And so it would be very few cities in Minnesota that would be held to the workforce plan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Jordan. That's super appreciated as a part of this bill. I support a lot of what's inside of this bill, and so to get that is great. And so I think that among members of this side of the aisle, one thing that we want to ensure is that hopefully that this is the amount of money that's needed to replace all lead lines in Minnesota. And as a part of that, that we in the small towns across the state have just as great of an opportunity to receive these grants as anyone here in this state. We have an equal opportunity for that.
Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. Representative Jordan, so I come from rural background, sit on SWCD's Southeast Minnesota Water Resource Board, Whitewater Joint Powers Board, and one of the frustrations that I get from my constituents is the administration costs to a lot of the water programs within the state. And so I'm looking at that $20 million figure for just for mapping. And is there any flexibility in that? I mean, just suppose it only really required $15 million to do the mapping. Is there flexibility there that more of that money could get to the actual program to fix the pipes?
Representative Jordan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jacob, yes. So if the mapping is completed and there's money left over, that can be used to replace lead service lines. Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Jacob.
So one follow-up question. Representative Burkle had asked about rural wells. So in my district, we have a lot of rural homeowners associations which are skirting the edges of cities or maybe part of suburbs of cities. So would those homeowner associations, would they be eligible for these funds?
Representative Jordan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jacob, if they are providing this water, like if it's just a homeowners association and they're not the ones that are actually providing the water connection, if they're providing the water connection and providing the drinking water to those homeowners, they would be eligible to apply for this and receive funds. But if it's just a homeowners association or, for example, someone asked earlier about like a county, for example, if the county's not providing the water, they're not eligible to for money to work on water work. And so if they're working on providing drinking water to homeowners, I think they would be eligible for this.
One follow-up question. So as a private landowner, I own a dozen properties, homes that I service with my own well. So I'm providing water to those dozen homes. So am I eligible?
Representative Jordan.
Representative Hansen, Representative Jacob, that is a good question that I don't have the answer off the top of my head.
Ms. Taylor would be able to answer for the law, but for the bill, excuse me.
Mr. Chair, members, I wouldn't know. I don't know if my colleague here would know.
Yep. Chair and members, Anna Shalene, House Research. This is probably a good question for the agency.
And Mr. Chair, we have the agency. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Freeman, go ahead. State your name for the record.
Yes. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Chad Colstead. I'm the supervisor of the infrastructure unit at the Minnesota Department of Health. As far as private wells, your private well concern, they would not be considered an eligible public water supply system. One thing with wells, though, is we have pretty good documentation of the age of the wells, so you can kind of do a background interpretation as to figure out if they have a lead service line or not. And a lot of wells, just based on the age of the wells, do not have lead service lines. Most of the wells that are out there now, the well that would be is in the 40s and 50s where lead would have been used, is probably no longer in use. Typically those wells don't last that long. Where it differentiates with the municipal system may have changed over and replaced wells or their source multiple times, but those lines to the home have changed versus a homeowner when you replace a well, those lines typically get replaced when they make that connection. So unless it's a really old home and that well never has been upgraded, more than likely it's probably not lead.
Representative Jacob.
So really it's more to do with whether it's a private well than, I mean, you've confused me a little bit with the age of the well. I have three wells. One was drilled in the 1800s and two of them were drilled more recently. So I don't think you're saying that just because the one is old that I'd be eligible. What you're saying is that because it's private, I would not be eligible.
I guess the eligibility through this bill is that it's only for public water supply systems. I guess what I was getting at is that typically private wells are not served by lead service lines. But in your case, if it's a well that's in the 1980s or 1800s, yes. There is a possibility. But for the most part, a lot of the wells do not last that long. So that's a pretty good instance where it may be. For the most part, we shouldn't have to be too concerned about private wells, but there's some potential out there.
Thank you.
So Representative Jordan, we've run a little bit over. I did ask for testifiers before, so I think we will go to a close. Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, what are you replacing the line? Do you have what they're going to be replaced with?
Representative Jordan.
Mr. Chair, that is not, Mr. Chair, Representative Scraba, that's not in the bill. I think that would be up to whatever the construction is happening at the time.
So we
just not lead.
We couldn't, recommend copper lines from northeastern Minnesota?
Oh, my goodness.
No. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just ask for member support. This is a bill that impacts my community, impacts all of yours, too. I think this discussion around a private well is interesting, and we should look into the IIJA money as it relates to private wells. I don't know what's in there or what it relates to wells, but this is a bill that is tailored to lead service lines, and we can do something about it.
Representative Jordan renews her motion that House File 24 as amended be recommended to be re-referred to the Capital Investment Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Ayes have it. The motion prevails. Congratulations. Next up is House File 1202. Representative Becker Finn.
Good
And Representative Becker Finn is on her way. Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have any idea how long we might be waiting? There are some folks in the audience that might be able to help us out. We were extremely limited in time yesterday, and we weren't able to ask questions. At least I wasn't able to. So if Dr. Larson was available, but if we, of course, have our bill author coming soon, we could defer.
The bill author is coming soon. I believe he's in the elevator. I did ponder maybe taking the last bill up, you know, if we were waiting time. But I think that Representative Becker Finn should be here momentarily. Just foreshadowing for next week, I think we have Mr. Strohmeyer, have we posted for Tuesday?
Mr. Chair, we've not posted yet, but we will be hearing a few bills on Tuesday, and then on Wednesday we'll be hearing starting the governor's budget recommendations for some of our smaller agencies.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In that foreshadowing, do we see any kind of overviews from agencies?
As Mr. Strohmeyer said, we'll be hearing overviews from the smaller agencies and their budget presentations. For example, Science Museum, the zoo, etc.
Since it appears we have a testifier, yep, I will wait.
Representative Becker Finn, welcome to the committee. I will move that House File 1202 be recommended to be re-referred to the Agriculture, Finance, and Policy Committee. Representative Becker Finn, I also have the A2 amendment. I would like to move that. Now I'd move the A2 amendment to make some corrections to the bill. Any questions on the A2 amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Motion prevails. A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Becker Finn, to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair Hansen, and it's good to be back in the Environment Committee. Have been working on this issue and served on the Environment Committee the whole time I've been in office. I won't repeat the critical testimony that was heard yesterday from Dr. Larson, Dr. Osterholm, and Chairman Dupuy, but I will reference that testimony as being instructive to this underlying bill for the record. There are more than 500,000 deer hunters in our state. There's actually more probably than even the DNR keeps track of due to our tribal deer hunters as well. And I'm one of them. I know it's can be triggering for some folks, confusing for others that a queer Native woman from the suburbs is the person who's been carrying this bill and fighting this issue. But that's the reality of who we are as deer hunters. Every single person in this committee has many of your constituents who are deer hunters, and they don't all fit the stereotypes. They come from all kinds of different backgrounds. Deer hunting is integral to who we are as Minnesotans. Our hunting tradition is strong and diverse. Further, our state constitution actually addresses hunting and fishing, and so I don't know how many of the newer members of this committee are aware of this, but Article 13, Section 12, preservation of hunting and fishing. Hunting and fishing and the taking of game and fish are a valued part of our heritage that shall be forever preserved for the people and shall be managed by law and regulation for the public good. And that preservation of our wildlife really should be for hunting, should be and must be legally under our Constitution our top priority as lawmakers as we talk about these kinds of issues. Finally, before I get into the nuts and bolts of the bill, I just want to center something that Chairman Dupuy said yesterday. As Anishinaabe people, this is our way of life. So when I talk about these issues and the reasons I fight for these issues, you know, it's for my ancestors, it's for what I want for my kids and future generations, and that's why I'm here today. I was raised and taught that we take care of the animals in the water, and the animals in the water take care of us. And it really is that that relationship that's important, and I think that's really critical as we look at this issue. So to now move on to sort of getting into the weeds a little bit, this is meant to be a more comprehensive bill. In past years, we've heard kind of piecemeal, multiple different ways to combat this problem. The hope this year, especially with a new chair over in the Senate, is that we can finally move this forward this year. So Section 1 of the bill would allow for the public to be aware of the location of cervid farms. Section 2 deals with escapes and how those should be handled, how quickly those need to be notified to the Commissioner of Natural Resources and others. Section 3 deals with fence repair, dictating how quickly those fence repairs are made and what type of fencing, as far as, you know, it's really important that we're, as we heard from Dr. Larson yesterday, that physical contact between farm cervids and wildlife is maintained, that we're keeping them separate. Section 4 is specific to white-tailed deer and requiring double fencing. Section 5 requires ear tags so we can more closely track the animals. Section 6 is a moratorium on new white-tailed deer cervid farms. Section 7 has some movement restrictions if there are positives within a herd, and also it has some additional fencing requirements and dictating that area that has been found to be positive is there's fencing maintained around that for 10 years, as we heard. CWD and the prions remain in the soil and the landscape for a long time. We also in Section 7 have a notice to buyers, so if you're purchasing hunting land, you're not inadvertently purchasing land that maybe isn't so great to hunt on. You know, we've had some issues with the Elk Run facility in Minnesota, and that how that has impacted the ability to build housing and other things on that land. Section 8 is a liability section. Section 9 has to do with importation, so the movement of farm cervids and cervid semen into the state. Section 10 is regarding federal funds. Section 11 is requiring consultation with the folks from the U of M who are doing this work, and requiring that they incorporate peer-reviewed scientific information. For whatever reason, this is an area of law where there's been a lot of not well-vetted, no pun intended, unvetted science shared, and so we want to make sure that that's peer-reviewed good science that we're following. Section 12 is a notice requirement so that counties and tribal governments and other local governments are aware if there's been a positive for chronic wasting disease. Section 13 was one of the sections that was amended in the A2 amendment that we just passed, and that has to do with live animal testing. Now that we have the ability to do that live animal testing through the developments that have been made at the University of Minnesota due to some of the work and the funding that we all did on this committee. Section 14 is the transfer of duties. So it's moving some of those duties strictly to the DNR so that they can put our wildlife as a top priority. There will be a new Section 15 that will be the funding, which is in the A2 amendment. And that final section is just reviser instruction, and that's the bill. I'm happy. I know we have some testifiers, and then happy to take questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Becker-Finn. First up, Patrick Boyle, St. Louis County Commissioner. Welcome, and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair and members. Patrick Boyle, St. Louis County Commissioner and Chair this year for the biggest landmass county this side of the Mississippi. And I want to tell you guys our story of St. Louis County. We have 700 leased hunting shacks, which is very unique for counties in Minnesota, on just under 1 million acres of tax forfeited land in St. Louis County. So it's very important up north for hunting. It's about generations spending time together, which this day and age we know is harder and harder to do. And it's as important that a lot of our families are still dependent on keeping venison in the freezer over the winter. So with St. Louis County, we've been monitoring this chronic wasting disease for years. And I think the last straw was what happened in Beltrami County a couple of years ago with their cerevid farm. When CWD came through, they had to eradicate their entire herd. They did so and then dumped the carcasses on county tax forfeited land there, which then the county was responsible to pick up fencing for just under $200,000 because that protein is there on the soil. So late last year, St. Louis County came up with a moratorium, first county in the state, on any expanded or new COVID farms in St. Louis County. And we're very proud of that. But with this, we know that we need help from the state, and that's why I'm here today. This has been going on for decades and decades. When I was in UW-Madison, I deer hunted, and it was a big issue just north of Madison. So this has been going on for a long time. The time is now to eradicate this and take care of it. The first out of the four big issues that I see, the number one issue that we have is the mixed messages from the Animal Board of Health and the DNR. For years and years, we've tried to find out what the right answer is for our county and have gotten different answers from each organization. One agency needs to run this for best practice management with these farms, and I truly believe the DNR is the one that should run that court. Number two, continue with the rapid testing of carcasses, so very important. Number three, the public education. Number four, proper disposable sites. We know this is a protein. There's only a few furnaces that can get that high to take care of these carcasses, to break down that protein. So this needs to be done. So with that, I look forward to seeing what you guys do. St. Louis County is always there to help you out. And if you guys pass this, I'll bring a crock pot of venison stew for you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jim Spreck, Minnesota Deer Farmers Association. Welcome, and state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Tim Spreck. I'm here today representing the interests of the Minnesota Deer Farmers Association. Mr. Chair, this is a very large and comprehensive bill with very dire and significant consequences for the deer farming industry. What I'm going to do today is hit most of the high points. We'll be available for questions. I also have two deer farmers with me, and also Dr. Scott Josephson is in the audience in case there are any follow-up questions from yesterday after his presentation. Mr. Chair, Section 1, Animal Premises Data. This violates privacy of cervidae farmers. This is something that's not done with any other livestock industry. It really sets them up to be taken advantage of, either because people are looking to find a way to attack them. It makes public data of their name, address, and it really sets them up for all kinds of problems. In the past, we've had a lot of vandalism on farms. We've had fences cut. We've had locks cut. We've had deer released, and these are valuable assets that we want to protect. Mr. Chair, this is a serious problem, violating the privacy of these individuals. Section 2, Subdivision 1, hunters kill and keep escaped cervidae. We spoke about this several times over the last year or two, but for the new members here on the committee today, this really violates personal property rights, takes away a person's property without any kind of compensation, and oftentimes the causes for escape are not negligence or problems with the deer farm industry, but rather it's done by vandalism, storm damage, or other things that are beyond their control. In this instance, we like to work with the current system that's in place, which gives the opportunity for the farmer to capture the deer, but also there are governmental agencies that can come in and take advantage of this to put down or capture the deer as well. This is the best system. We don't want to put hunters in a position where they're being sued for taking away someone else's personal property rights. Section 2, Subdivision 1. There's some issues with this where it's somewhat unclear. A positive test would likely require quarantine and depopulation regardless of the situation. So oftentimes when we see these type of provisions, we need clarifications, but also it appears as though it's not necessary or even applicable given the current situation. Section 3, under fencing. Even though it's not mentioned in the text of the bill, this would essentially require double fencing to stop all contact between live and wild, or excuse me, farmed and wild deer. There's no evidence that CWD can transfer through the fence. In fact, there's an excellent study being conducted now at the University of Minnesota by Dr. Wells, which takes all of these things into account. And his preliminary findings indicate that transfer through a fence is actually not likely. It's more likely that it's scavengers or birds flying over or coming through or around or under the fence that would cause this particular transmission vector. So what we're looking at now is double fencing is prohibitively expensive. The people that I've talked to that are in this industry that have, especially if they have a preserve, this could be a $50,000 to $100,000 hit that they'd be having to take on their annual expenses to get this double fencing up and running. So the concern we have is that this would drive a number of them out of business and further deplete the deer farming industry. Fence deficiencies are already repaired immediately. There are motivations to do so. If there's a storm that comes through and a tree falls on a fence, a farmer is certainly going to get out there immediately and repair it to the best of their ability. They're not going to just let their animals run away. These are valuable animals. Oftentimes breeding stock can be in the tens of thousands of dollars. There's motivation to take care of their own and to deal with their own fencing issues. Also under this section, the language does not give the Board of Animal Health discretion in these type of situations where they can make a call on storm damage or shortage of materials or other items that may cause fencing issues to become a problem. Double fence farms have had spontaneous eruptions of chronic wasting disease in the past. Double fencing is not the cure, and what we're looking at is the other vectors that could cause spontaneous eruption of CWD on the farm, as I mentioned earlier. Section 4, commercial herd fencing 10 feet high. Once again, there's no proof that a deer can jump over 8 feet. This is just another punitive measure that would cause great financial hardship upon the industry and would not do anything to solve the problem of escapes. There is no evidence that deer have ever jumped an 8-foot fence, and this is nationwide. It's prohibitively expensive. Section 5, identification of fawns within 14 days of birth. Mr. Chair, this is a solution in search of a problem. What we're doing is we're forcing a deer farm owner to put a tag on a fawn's ear within 14 days of birth. Now, we know, those of us that hunt deer understand how skittish deer can be. Picture a doe with a fawn that they're protecting, and what's going to happen if you try to handle that deer within 14 days of birth. You're going to cause does running into fences. You're going to cause fawns being injured and killed. You're going to create a whole host of problems and havoc within the deer farm, and it's not going to solve anything. Deer are tagged two ways. There's a USDA button tag, and then there's a large, what they call a panel tag. And if they have to put a panel tag on the ears of these small fawns, it's going to damage the fawns, it's going to tear the ears, and it's going to cause irreparable damage to the aesthetic. So we have to be very cautious when we try to legislate things that we don't really fully understand. And that's why I brought some members of the deer farming industry with today to discuss these things. And I hope that you'll ask them practical questions. Section 5, no new farms. This is really a slow, calculated death for deer farms. It phases them out over time, and make no mistake about it, this is the end of the industry. It will take some time to get there, but it will be the end. And I will put this one thought out today for the committee. If we really want to get rid of them that badly, let's not do death by a thousand cuts. Let's buy them out. Let's buy them out in a way that's respectful to the industry, to the work that they put into their farming operations, and give them a way out of the industry where they can hold their head high with dignity without being crushed under the heavy hand of government. Section 7, no movement of CWD positive deer. It's already illegal to move a deer that's tested CWD positive. This is a redundancy, and it's already being taken care of in current law and practice. Inspectors are already allowed on CWD positive farms. In fact, the USDA has to come in, Board of Animal Health has to come in, and I believe that DNR also is involved in this situation. So if a farm ever does go positive, there's complete access by governmental agencies. Section 7, maintaining fencing for 10 years. Mr. Chair, this is not based on science. It's based on conjecture, and it's based on guesses by people who have expertise in the industry. So are we going to penalize the landowner and cause them to hold their farms under fencing for 10 years? The current 5-year requirement is more than sufficient unless additional information comes to play. It also doesn't allow for any kind of latitude in this situation if new technology becomes available that would allow cleanup or would show that prions are no longer viable. Section 7, recording with the county recorder. Mr. Chair, this is a permanent encumbrance on the title of the property. It has no allowance for science, cleaning up prion viability, as I just mentioned. And in Minnesota, we have a disclosure state. Anytime a piece of property is put up for sale, all material defects must be disclosed, and this is the best way to handle this without placing a permanent encumbrance on the title. Section 7, disposal of CWD positive cervidae. USDA indemnification process already takes care of the disposal. This is something that happens. USDA comes in, they assess the herd, they make the payment, they take possession of the animals, and they take care of disposal. Not necessary, and it is also redundant in current practice. And then we're on Section 8, liability. Importation from a CWD positive herd is already prohibitive. There's an extensive number of protocol that has to be gone through with regard to importation, and we do not import anything from anyone infected. Board of Animal Health would comment on this if you would care to have clarification. Section 8, liability for illegal disposal. This is the bugaboo in the whole discussion that we're having today. Now, the Beltrami County was clearly out of line. When that operation, for whatever reason, dumped CWD-positive carcasses on the landscape, I immediately drafted a letter with the president of the Deer Farmers Organization condemning this issue and sent copies to each of the committee chairs in both the Ag and the Environment Committees of both bodies at that time. We do not condone lawbreakers, but we cannot condemn an entire industry because someone broke the law. Those people are liable for whatever they've done, and the law will take care of them in its own way. Section 9, no importation from CWD positive herd. We've already discussed this. Section 9 under the semen issue. As you heard yesterday, semen importation is critically important to develop genetically resistant herds. We're looking to get the genetic resistant semen with the two of the four alleles so that we can breed genetic resistance. Mr. Chair, the deer farmers are going to solve the problem of CWD, but we have to allow them to import semen. Dr. Josephson spoke about that yesterday in great detail and with great expertise, and as I said, he would be here today, or he is here today, available if there are questions, and he's also submitted a letter for your review in your packets. I'm going to skip down to probably Section 13, whitetail deer testing required, and this encompasses the amendment that was also added today. And I think the most important thing that we need to understand about RTQIC, no matter how much we want it, how much we need it, and how much and how close we are, USDA still has not approved the use of RTQIC. As you recall, last year in committee, we presented a letter by Dr. Torreson indicating that if the U of M used RTQIC, there would be severe and dire consequences. I have a copy of that letter today that you may review if you would like. RTQIC is not a viable solution, even though we all want it. We want it not only for hunters, but for deer farmers. And then we're going to go to Section 14, transfer to the DNR. DNR really lacks the expertise and needs the Board of Animal Health to help them through with this situation. If we transfer to the DNR, what we're doing is we're making a decision that puts them in a position where they're still going to have to contract with the Board of Animal Health, especially when it comes to disease management, and the board has done an excellent job. Here are a couple facts that we all need to consider. In over 20 years, there have been only 13 farms with CWD out of over 600. On those farms, 54 animals have been CWD positive out of over 9,300 tested. Deer farms are the most highly regulated of all livestock operations. There's no evidence that any farm-raised deer have ever transmitted CWD to the wild. In spite of what we heard, these are the facts, and this is what the science is telling us. We must work within these facts and keep this up, this industry alive so that it can help us solve the problem of CWD. We need to embrace the deer farm as a partner rather than an enemy. And it's very frustrating for me when I come before these committees, because we have the capability with the hunting groups and the ag groups and the deer farmers to solve this problem, but we've got to stop demonizing and we've got to think of each other as partners. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I will stand aside.
And Mr. Spreck, I gave you great latitude and time
appreciate
to make
that.
Sure that you could provide all of that testimony on behalf of the deer farmers.
I greatly appreciate that, Mr. Chair, because, like I said, it's comprehensive and the consequences are dire.
There are several other testifiers. I'm going to go to Eric Simonson with the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Eric Simonson, in this case, lobbyist representing the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, a nonprofit group formed officially in 1980. An association that now reaching over 20,000 members, created by hunters and for hunters. For the past 40 plus years, the MDHA has been building a hunting and conservation legacy through habitat, education, and advocacy. We want to express our gratitude to Representative Becker Finn for bringing forward House File 1202, and we want to express our support of the bill as amended to the members of the committee. I do not have to tell any of you that the impact CWD has had and seems to continue to have on the wild deer habitat in Minnesota. One does not need to look very far beyond our borders to fully appreciate and understand the impacts of not pursuing a more aggressive strategy toward reducing the spread of CWD. It is a standing legislative priority of our group to advocate for double fencing and better enforcement on cervid farms. Thank you to Representative Becker Finn, Chair Hansen, and the committee for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 1202 as amended, and we look forward to continued conversations as the bill moves forward. Thank you.
Tony Quillis, Elk Breeders Association.
Afternoon, members of the committee. I will try and be short. My name is Tony Quillis, and I'm representing the Minnesota Elk Breeders Association this afternoon. And I have with me Brenda Harkoff, who is the executive director of the Elk Breeders, and two members of the board, Jim Byrne and Jerry Campbell, if I need to phone a friend, Mr. Chairman. But just to reiterate previous testimony, Mr. Chairman, some of the concerns that I have deal with the Section 1 and the data privacy concerns there. The other livestock that are controlled and regulated by the Board of Animal Health, such as cattle, turkey, hogs, and horses, do not have this, do have their data publicly released, Mr. Chairman. So there is a concern there. Representative Becker Finn and I have had this debate over the years of elk hunting. Elk hunting is only usually the legal season is from August to December up in northern Minnesota. But the key word as we work through that is kill and possess. If we have an animal that actually has gotten out, we want to be able to control the test. There's two types of tests. It's called the ELISA test and the IHC test, which is the gold standard. We want to be able to test the animal because we want to know that if it's positive also, and if it's positive, how to dispose of it. So the key word there, though, is kill and possess. So we would try and make sure that we were able to at least have access to the animal to have the tests. Mr. Chairman, just below that, it talks about escape farm cervid. And we don't want escape farm cervid either, but there are times where there is a natural disaster, such as a tree falling or unfortunate incident of vandalism. So just would like to discuss that a little bit further with Representative Becker Finn. Also, what, Mr. Chairman, in Section 3, where we talked about physical contact between farmed cervid and free-roaming cervid, what that entails, if we could get some clarification there, if shade cloth or electric fencing would qualify there. And also right now, through when we talk about preventing physical contact between farmed cervidae and free-roaming, the Department of Natural Resources and the Board of Animal Health right now, as they go through and do their co-inspections, have been doing a good job along with, it's been referenced, Dr. Scott Wells and the biosecurity to make sure that what I'll call kind of best management practices, keep your food and water away from fence line and other things for biosecurity purposes. So I'd like to work with Representative Becker Finn along those lines. Also, when we talk about fence, we remove the language that says within a reasonable time of determined by the Board of Animal Health. We can move the animals and secure the animals in a different pen, Mr. Chairman, but I think what you saw just in the last month in terms of weather, where we had the heavy, wet snow brought down a tree, it might be a large enough tree where I can't control it. I have to call a landscape company to come do it. They're obviously going to be busy because other trees are down. To be able to do that, and then we had that really cold snap, would I be able to get pole diggers into the ground there, Mr. Chairman? So just maybe allowing the Board of Animal Health to have and determine that reasonable time. The 5 to 10 years, Mr. Chairman, on page 5 from 511 down to 514, that's the federal rules and regulations right now under USDA, Mr. Chairman. So I'd just like to point that out. And then some concerns also with the sell and transfer of the property. Mr. Chairman, we would also have some concerns there. Section 8 regarding the liability, completely understand the unlawful disposal. But upon the owner's sale, Mr. Chairman and members, incubation period for elk for CWD is about 3 years. So I could have an individual sale where I sell it, and there is a chance maybe two and a half years later that CWD would show up. So if I could suggest some language, Mr. Chairman, where it might say farm cervid known to be or reason to believe had CWD, and again, that's something like to have some conversations about. Also, Mr. Chairman, in Section 9 about the importation of semen, this actually decreases the movement of animals because we don't have to move bulls then for breeding purposes. I have not seen any peer-reviewed science yet that not once in a lab experiment or in live use that CWD has been transferred, Mr. Chairman. And then finally, I think that there's going to be some enforcement and regulations and challenges there. Mr. Chairman, and the last one I had was in Section 11, where it talks about the Board of Animal Health and the DNR must consult with the University of Minnesota. We need to utilize their expertise, completely understandable, Mr. Chairman. But when we talk about enforcing 35.155, that includes fencing, identification, inspection. So if we could figure out what the authority and powers of the U would be in that, and I think we've touched on that. And we should utilize their experience, but that 35.155 talks about fencing, identification, inspection, like I said, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the time. I really appreciate it, Mr. Chairman, and we'll be around to answer any questions if you need be.
Thank you. We have two other folks who have signed up from the Deer Farmers Association, Deb Holtis and Scott Fear, if they could come together and testify. Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Scott Fear. I'm the president of the Minnesota Deer Farmers Association.
I'm Deb Holtis. I'm a deer farmer up in central Minnesota. I've been in agriculture my whole life. I'm not going to say how many years that'll date me.
You could provide your
House Floor 1202 would cause extreme hardship on our industry, and essentially it'd be our death sentence. Deer provide income for our families, put our kids through college, and we have a substantial impact on our communities. You know, as far as the double fencing, it's going to get extremely expensive, and we don't have the funds to do it. And furthermore, I mean, there's no data support to support that double fencing is effective. We have farms in the United States that have been double fenced for 25 years, have had closed herds, never moved an animal on their property, and they're still getting CWD. How can that be? There's also been some interesting studies in Michigan where they did some fence line videotaping of the, there's 77,000 hours of video recording, which is equivalent to about close to 9 years. And in that study, there was two contacts of deer nose to nose from wild to pen. So very minimal that way. Getting to the tags, I've done this before. It's literally inhumane, in my opinion, to do it. Put that big tag in those little fawns, it creates ear infection. They rip them out, which causes ear infection as well, which leads to death. And I really don't see any purpose in doing it at 14 days of age. As far as the RT quick test, it's not a USDA certified test, so how can we use it? And who's going to pay for it? And as far as regulatory authority, I think the Board of Animal Health should regulate us. They are experts in animal health, and we are a livestock industry, and I believe they do a fantastic job. There's not one person or one group in this entire room or this state that wants to sell CWD more than the cervid producers. So let's work together. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm going to reiterate everything Scott has said and add a few more things. In our small communities, we live in small communities, most of us, in our viable agricultural industry, we support our small communities through feed, vehicle purchases, equipment, veterinarian services, and by taking us out, we will now have an economic impact on those small communities as well. I'm a traditional family farm. I've been farming my whole life. It's been passed down from generations to generations, so I understand tradition. The exciting part that we have coming in our industry right now is, one, we're a controlled group. We're fenced. We can be tested. We are tested. We are now introducing genetic markers that are going to help with CWD resistance, and we think we can do this. We know we can do this. We are already implementing these safeguards because we want resistant deer as well. It will help our industry as well. So if you have any questions, I would invite everyone in the audience and committee members to an educational farm tour. We're always available to have farm tours for the public. We do a lot of that, and we love to see you no matter what side of the aisle you're on. We want to work together. Remember, Governor Walz, One Minnesota. Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify? We have one more person that wants to testify.
Thank you.
State your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Zandmiller. I'm with Bluffland Whitetails, and I'm also a member of the CWD Action Coalition. I'm here to speak in favor of House File 1202. I don't want to roll through this, but I do want to point out that there are opportunities for common interest to come through. Earlier today, I listened to the Board of Animal Health's meeting and the presentations that were brought on about management techniques and concerns, and I heard them here again today. If there is a concern about birds transmitting CWD to herds, then maybe we need to consider putting bird netting over these facilities. This is an issue that the deer farmers have identified as a possible transmission vector. Perhaps that needs to be included. We also have a position paper out, and it's available at the back of the room, that also says, let's not do this by death by a thousand cuts. Let's just get rid of it. But absent that, it makes sense to put some controls on things. If you're in a darkened room, you do not run for the door. You feel your way out. Since so much of CWD is unknown to us, it behooves us to stop and feel our way through this until we're confident in a direction to go. This is important across so many areas, and I get it. This is a means of income for many people. But the Action Coalition believes that if we did buy them out, that there would be some opportunity to compensate them for their losses. But if we can't do that, this is a good start. What I can say unequivocally true is what we have now is not sufficient. We need to move that needle more. Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify? Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to this. I do have my 12-year-old daughter in the audience today. And, you know, she's a deer hunter, Mr. Chair. And our particular area has been significantly affected by the discovery of a positive. And, you know, we take this very seriously, this issue, and this committee has worked hard on this. We've had numerous hearings over the last few years. And, you know, just a statement, I guess. I hope that everyone read the coalition letter. It was, you know, really good, and I appreciate their position that they brought forward in the letter. And near as I can tell, just about every request that they're seeking is covered in the bill. Maybe I missed something, but the one thing that is missing is a buyout. I hope that, as has been mentioned numerous times today, death by a thousand cuts isn't the priority here. I hope that we're looking to work on this issue as a whole. And I've proposed legislation as recently as last session that would have moved a buyout forward. And that wasn't allowed to move through our process here in the House. I do hope that we see something of that come through this year. If that wasn't the case, that would be a disappointment. Thank you for the time, Mr. Chair.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Chair. And I do want to correct the record on a couple things, but I think directly to those comments, you know, the priority here is to protect the wild herd. That's the priority. I will also say, you know, we've been having these conversations for years, and just for the record, nobody reached out to me with any suggestions for amendments. I am a firm believer in the committee process and using that committee process to make things better. As far as some of the previous comments that were made, I just want to make sure that it's clear what's actually in the bill. As far as consultation with the University of Minnesota, there's no authority granted. It's just requiring that there be consultation with good scientific research going on. As far as RT Quick, the USDA isn't the only arbiter of scientific validity. If other scientists believe that it's good science, it's good science, whether it's been added to some list by a specific agency. As far as the liability provisions, if folks are so sure that everything they're doing is above board, then they shouldn't have any problem with this. I also want to clarify that what happened with the illegal dumping, there's a difference between criminal liability and civil liability, and we want to make sure that folks can be reimbursed if, you know, as an example, we've had a hunter, and this relates to both the liability provision and the escape provision. We had an instance in southern Minnesota where a deer hunter, following all the rules, deer hunting as he's allowed to do, as licensed to do, shot a deer and realized that it had a tag on it, and it was actually a farmed deer that had been escaped and hadn't been reported. He was really excited about the big buck that he got, and the original owner who allowed their property to go missing then wanted the antlers back after that hunter lawfully took that deer. And so we're trying to clarify some of those things as well. A lot of other things I could say, but I think you know, the main thing is just to highlight the fact that this is the only species that is farmed and sold commercially, that is also something, the same species that is legally, constitutionally protected in our state. And so that's why there are going to be some issues that are different than the way we treat other livestock in a perfect world, we never would have started taking a wild animal and messing with it in this way to begin with. I think some of the comments about some of the genetic savior ideas, like kind of getting into some Island of Dr. Moreau territory, and we got to be really careful about treating wild animals like wild animals. You know, we don't just release other things into the wild and keep our fingers crossed that it goes okay. I read a lot of science fiction, and I would suggest that we not do that. But again, Chair, I am always happy to work on this. We want to get this done. The goal is to protect our wild herd. What this means for my family, you know, I appreciate Representative Heitzman talking about his daughter. My children also hunt, and we have also had positive CWD from two different places within 10 miles of where I hunt on my home reservation. And the idea that my children may not be able to hunt and eat that venison safely is deeply disturbing, and I think it would be for a lot of families who rely on venison. So that's why we're here, and always happy to have conversation on this issue.
I had a couple more members who have comment. Representative Heinzman, if we can try to finish, we've heard the last bill before several times too. So Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will keep my comments short then. I'm concerned about this idea of a buyout. My district that I represent has numerous Superfund sites, and my constituents who bear the brunt of that harm from those Superfund sites to their health and to their property values, it's not their job to pay for the cleanup of that Superfund site. It's General Mills' job. It's not my constituents' job to pay for the mess that these for-profit enterprises have created. I have deep concerns about having my constituents who do not own deer farms pay for this mess for a profit venture. This isn't like this is an avian flu situation where it is something that happened naturally in the landscape. The biohazard that we discussed yesterday is something that happened as a result of these for-profit ventures, and I would have serious concerns about asking my constituents to pay for this mess. My constituents, it is not their problem, and it is not their fault that this has happened to the public land that they own. My constituents have to use public land to hunt deer because that is the only area that is available to them. So I think taking care of public land is all of our responsibility. Taking care of something that was created by these farms is not my constituents' responsibility. And I would need to have much more conversation about a buyout before we just sort of bandy that about. But I want to really commend Chair Becker Finn for her work on this. She's been very dogged and has made the case about how CWD is a statewide issue. It is an issue that pertains to all of our constituents. I have many constituents and family members that deer hunt. I have constituents who also rely on wild deer for their protein and for their nutritional value. So thank you for this. And I think we need to have a much, much deeper conversation talking about a buyout before we just start throwing that out there as plan A. So I think this is a much better plan A and plan B, C, D, E, F, G than going straight to a buyout. Thank you.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll make this very brief. I just would like to correct the record. So there's a researcher at the University of Minnesota who has been quoted extensively today and yesterday, and her name is Dr. Samantha Wells. So just to have that on the record, thank you.
Any other questions to the bill, which is the motion is to go to the Ag Committee, and then it will go to the Civil Law Committee. So. Representative Becker Finn, close.
I feel like I've said everything that needs to be said on this bill, but again, you know, for the legislative intent here is that we protect our wild deer herd for ourselves and future generations, and appreciate the committee's time and support.
I renew my motion that House File 1202 as amended be recommended to be re-referred to the Agriculture, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Congratulations. Next up, I think we'll just go from here. Representative Heinzman, you're okay with us going, right?
Representative Hansen, would you like to move your bill?
I will move that House File 722 be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Representative Hansen, to the bill.
Madam Chair, House File 722 is an incentive program for the Conservation Reserve to try to have members sign up to enroll in the CRP, the federal CRP program. We have a pilot project that was part of the LCCMR compromise last year. This appropriates $5 million. My reason for this would provide long-term carbon storage and habitat and water quality protection on an existing program. It would be things like providing a sign-up bonus to help. It would not be paying extra for the easement, but trying incentives to try to get enrollment. I would ask for your support.
Questions?
One quick thing. And I do have CRP land, and I would not be enrolling.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Are there questions from members on House File 722? Further discussion on the bill? And is there anyone in the audience, looks like we lost most of our audience, that would like to testify for or against the bill? Closing remarks, Representative Hansen.
Members, this was, we've heard this several years. We do have a pilot project out there. This is a great opportunity for one-time money to incent landowners into the Conservation Reserve Program.
With that, Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 722 be recommended to be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
The motion prevails. And with that, members, we are adjourned.